Okay, welcome everybody. This is the, I think, sixth office hours session for Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology Through Price Theory. We're getting into the home stretch of our course, and I hope a lot of you are thinking about taking the follow-up class. It's going to go through the next five chapters of the book. It's, of course, it's in my interest to tell you this, but it really is. I am excited to not only wrap up this course, but to dive into the next one, because it's Rockford really, you know, he's sort of just warming us up in these first four chapters, and then he's going to really explain the heart of a market economy in the next five. And just so you know, I came from the gym, but I decided to look like a bum because it is the Mises Chase shirt there. So anyway, I thought it might be appropriate to leave that on instead of putting on a nicer shirt. Okay, great. We've got some questions already in the queue. An easy one. Jan says, Mr. Frodo Merpins, did you throw the Ring of Power in the Mountain of Doom when in Mordor 2 weeks ago? Yeah, actually, here, I'll post that for you guys. Somebody finally did compile a short, you know, like a, what do you call it, a compilation of my testimony, so it's down, it's only 11 minutes long. So if you're interested in that, don't watch it now, because otherwise you'll miss the office hours. But there's that URL if you're curious. So yeah, if you didn't know about it, I did, there's a neat part in there where Dennis Kucinich just out of nowhere asks me what we should do with the Fed. So I told him. Okay, let's see, I think we had a real question here. Okay, Dennis Foster says, if we can say that consumption only occurs during leisure time, wouldn't that be sufficient to claim that leisure is desirable? Yeah, I mean, that's true, but I'm not trying to be a wise guy, but I just want to show you the sense in which it's true. I mean, if we also could say that consumption can only occur between 3 and 4 in the afternoon, well, then other things equal, wouldn't people like 3 and 4 between being 3 and 4 in the afternoon? So they would, but the question is that first thing, is that a move we want to make to get that outcome? So I'm not, there's two things. One is I'm not sure if Rockford is being totally consistent with some of his definitions, because in the questions for the professors and those threads, some of you have been asking pretty tough questions about, well, he says this on one page, but then over here he says something else, and how those things get reconciled. So I'm not sure that the framework he has is totally, there's real interesting borderline cases where if you're reading the passage in one section, you'd think it would go a certain way. If you read something else, it looks like it might go the other way. All right, so I'm not saying that the way he sets up the framework in the book is necessarily airtight. But the other thing is, I don't think there's if you polled, let me put it this way, if you polled 100 different Austrian economists, because there's at least 100 of us now, that may not have always been the case, but if you polled 100 of us and said, can you derive consumption from your labor, you know, like can your work itself be directly pleasurable, and so then are you consuming and working at the same time? I'm not sure all 100 people would give you the same answer. Okay, so my point is, I think, because this is not so much an issue of economics, it's almost more philosophy. It's almost more, you know, do you want to conceive of people being able to strive after multiple ends with the same action? Or by definition, do you want to say every action just has one goal in mind? Or do you want to say that the same physical body movements or, you know, the same event in terms of physics or sociology or something, do you want to say in terms of praxeology, that's actually multiple actions at the same time? Okay, so let me just, I just want to make sure you understand what I'm saying, the distinction between those viewpoints. That, and I personally, I would have to think about it myself. If you ask me off the top of my head, I'm not sure which way I would want to go with it. Okay, so somebody like Roderick Long, who's a philosopher who's very familiar with praxeology, he probably would be able to talk about this topic a lot better than I could, or Joe Salerno or Guido Hulsman, because Guido and Salerno and I are economists first, and that's, you know, that's how we come to praxeology, whereas Roderick Long is a philosopher. So I mean, he has thought about means ends frameworks and value scales and stuff like that in terms of just their nature a lot more than we have, because we just use it for the purposes of economics. So we don't really think about that stuff too much. So if there's like minefields, and you better not think of it this way because then you get into trouble three steps down, we might not realize that because we haven't read a bunch of people discussing means ends frameworks the way Roderick might have. Okay, because I mean that kind of stuff. I'm sort of rambling here, but I keep realizing more and more about this question because it's a pretty important or it's a pretty deep question. Mises did not invent the notion of a means end framework off the top of his head. Okay, Mises didn't invent the idea of a priori theorizing. Okay, he got all that stuff from philosophy, in particular, you know, he drew heavily on the work of Immanuel Kant. Okay, so my point is just philosophers who specialize in what's called epistemology, the study of how do we know things, I mean, they would know a lot of this terminology, okay, and, you know, going back to the Greeks, a lot of the stuff that Mises is drawing on, and he's applying it to economics, okay, so that's part of what's going on here, is Mises was just an incredibly well-read guy. He had a command of several different disciplines. He wasn't just an economist. He also read a lot of history, a lot of philosophy, and so forth. He was also actually, he knew a lot about mathematics, like higher mathematics, too. That's why he could offer his own interpretation of probability theory. I mean, it's, the guy's impressive. I mean, whether he's right or wrong on these things, I mean, it's kind of impressive that in human action he's going off on all these tangents. So when it comes to, you know, understanding what is leisure or what is labor, I mean, there, that if you at high enough level, it gets pretty abstract because it gets real philosophical. And so that's what I'm getting at, that it's not an economics issue to say, When you labor, can you be consuming at that point, or by definition, are you not consuming? Okay, because that, your answer to that isn't, you know, the economics isn't so much going to drive it, because you can still explain actual labor markets as an economist and talk about wage rates and stuff, no matter how you answer that question, because you can say, no, by definition, you cannot consume when you're working. And so if you are at a job and part of it is you enjoy being there because, you know, you're working in an amusement park and you like seeing Donald Duck and Disney and Mickey Mouse walk around, well then that actually isn't work when you see them. You're briefly not working and you're consuming. But then still, when you're trying to decide which job do I want to take, do I want to go work at Disney World and get paid $10 an hour, or do I want to go work in the office as a secretary and get $15 an hour, you can still explain that as an economist. If you go and work at Disney World, I think, oh, you get the $10 an hour, but also you get a lot of consumption in there because the job's not 8 hours a day. It's, you know, there's brief snippets of the day where you're not working and you're just looking at Donald Duck and think he's funny. Okay, so, or you can say, no, you work 8 hours a day and you also derive consumption from seeing Disney characters walking around. So the abstract question of can you consume while you're laboring, either way you answer that, it doesn't matter. You're still, as an economist, going to be able to explain the labor market. So in terms of how should we answer that question, it's more of a philosophical thing to have an internally coherent framework. And so that's the kind of thing that most other economists don't even care about, whereas Austrians in the tradition of Mises would, because Mises was a very logical, precise thinker. Okay, so that's the idea. Your question is, you're right, if we go that route, then what you said makes sense, but some people might not want to go that route because that might conflict with the way they systematically handle those types of definitions. Okay. Let's see. Okay, question from Jen says, is there a reason why Rothbard treats elasticity differently from the mainstream? Can we say the mainstream approach to elasticity is wrong, or is it just different? I'm not sure why Rothbard does that, to be honest with you. I don't think the mainstream way is wrong, because Rothbard later on, he kind of uses a version of it in a different application. So I don't think there's anything that's... Let me back up and make sure everyone remembers what we're talking about. So when Rothbard's talking about elasticity, the way he defines it is he says the elasticity, price elasticity of demand, he defines it as if the price goes up, let me make sure I don't get mixed up and say it backwards. If the price goes up, then the quantity demanded goes down, right? That's the law of demand. That's got to be true if you've got a downward sloping demand curve. Or it either goes, quantity demand either goes down or stays the same. So there's two things going on. If the price goes up, the seller is getting more revenue per unit, but is either getting the same number of units or more likely getting fewer units. And so that tendency would lower the revenue. And so then when you put the two effects together, you're not sure which way it goes. And so Rothbard says that if the total revenue goes up, then at that point on the demand curve, the demand was inelastic. Okay, because the price goes up by a certain amount, the quantity demanded falls by a smaller percentage, so that the price times quantity is a higher figure. And so so total revenue goes up, so that's an inelastic demand. Whereas if total revenue goes down because you raise prices, then you would say the demand in that region of the demand curve is elastic. And again, remember, the mnemonic, the way you remember that is, if something's elastic, it's real stretchy. And so just think, if for a little change in price, if the quantity really shrinks, or a little drop in price, the quantity expands a lot, we'll then say it's elastic. Okay, and so if the quantity is moving more than the price is, then that's going to change which way the total revenue goes. So since that's the way Rothbard is defining elasticity in terms of what happens, which way does total revenue go if you change the price, he says that's only an interesting concept for demand. He says, but for supply, it's not interesting, because for any upward sloping supply curve, when you increase the price, total revenues go up, and when you decrease the price, total revenues go down, because the quantity always moves in the same way, right? Because for a supply curve, when the price goes up, the quantity goes up also. So obviously, the total revenues being spent on the product, if you're looking at the supply curve, always go up with an increase in price, and they always go down with a decrease in price. Okay, so that's why in Man, Economy, and State, in the section that we already read, talking about elasticity, Rothbard says, it's an interesting concept for demand, but the elasticity of supply is, goofy. Who cares? So what I was telling you guys in the lecture is, just be careful. Don't file that away and think that that's something all economists would agree with, because the way mainstream economists, if you take, you know, a college course in economics, the way they define elasticity, it's not what Rothbard did. They define elasticity as a numerical procedure. That it's the you divide the percentage change in price divided by the percentage change in quantity, and then if that number, oh wait, where is it the other way around? No, it's the other way around. It's you divide the percentage change in quantity divided by the percentage change in price, and take the absolute value, and then if that quantity is greater than one, then what's called the price elasticity of demand is elastic. If it's less than one, then it's inelastic, and if it's exactly one, it's unitary elastic. Okay, so it's still true using that concept. It's still true that if you're looking at demand and you use that formula, if it's greater than one, it's still true then that you would say, oh, if the demand is elastic, an implication of that fact is that if the seller raises prices, then total revenue goes down. And if it's inelastic, then the revenues go up. Okay, and if it's perfectly elastic, then the revenues stay the same. Okay, so that there is still that aspect to it, but what Rothbard was holding up is the definition. A mainstream economist would say, no, that's not the definition. That's just an implication of the definition for demand curves. Okay. So if you're using that formula of, you know, what elasticity means is percentage change in quantity divided by percentage change in price, and then you take the absolute value of that, you can still apply that meaningfully to supply. And so when it comes to supply curves, yeah, it makes sense to say, suppose I increase prices by 10%, we know the quantity supplied is going to either stay the same or go up. But does it go up by 10% or less than 10%? And then if it goes up by more than 10%, you would say, oh, supply is elastic, meaning the supply, you know, expands or shrinks based on changes in the price by more than the price change. That's what elasticity of supply refers to, and that's a perfectly meaningful concept. All right, so that's one thing going on. And then when you say, well, is it useful? Well, the reason Rothbard needs to have the elasticity notion that he brings up is because later on when we deal with monopoly theory, that's where it comes into play. And so I think that's one of the reasons he introduced it, is because he's going to use it later on in the book. The use to which mainstream economists put it, it is true they use it for monopoly theory, but they also use it when they're analyzing the impact of a tax. So if you want to say, for example, the government comes along and puts a $1 per pack tax on cigarettes and says that, okay, any merchant who sells a pack of cigarettes has to send the government $1 as a surcharge, you know, surtax on cigarettes. A lot of people would just say, oh, that's going to hurt, you know, we'll put you this way. And then the government's trying to decide, do we impose the $1 tax on the retailer, or do we impose it on the consumer? Okay, and so the difference would be that you know, whatever the price is and the consumer pays, and that's it. So the consumer just pays whatever the price tag is, and then the seller now is an additional liability, has to send a dollar to the government. Or when the consumer takes the cigarette pack to the cashier and the cashier types in the sticker price, then does the cash register automatically add a dollar onto that, and the consumer has to pay an extra dollar out of his wallet? Okay, so the average person would probably think that makes a difference, whether the government imposes the tax on the retailer or on the consumer. But most economists would say, no, that doesn't matter. The sticker price would adjust, so it's going to be the same either way. And so the way you know who ends up paying that dollar is you look at the elasticities of the supply and demand for cigarettes. Okay, and so it's the side of the market that is more elastic pays less of the tax. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, in case you have no clue what I mean here. So let's say originally a pack of cigarettes is, I don't smoke, I don't know how much they cost. I know they cost ridiculous amounts in New York, but that's if they tax it so heavily. I don't know what the pre-tax price is. I'm just making this up. Let's say it's $3 for a pack of a pack of cigarettes. And so the government comes along and says, okay, we're going to put $1 per pack tax on it, and we're going to charge it to the retailer. Okay, so the person selling it doesn't include the price at the counter. You know, they just charge whatever the sticker price is. The consumer pays that, and then as a separate thing, at the end of the month, the retailer has to keep track of how many packs of cigarettes they sold, and they have to send us, you know, that number, that many dollar bills. So you might think that, oh, that means the retailer is bearing the brunt of it, but no. If the supply of cigarettes is very elastic and the demand is very inelastic, what can happen is the retail price of cigarettes might go up to $3.90, and before it was $3. So yes, technically, the consumer isn't paying the tax. The consumer just looks on the shelf, and the pack of cigarettes has a price tag on it that says $3.90. The consumer brings it up to the cash register, they ring it up, and the consumer pays $3.90. And then it's a separate transaction. The retailer has to send $1 into the government. But relative to the original equilibrium price, effectively what's happened is the consumer is paying 90 cents of the tax, and the retailer is only paying 10 cents. Because once the tax gets implemented, what happens is the supply curve shifts to the left so that the market price goes up 90 cents relative to what it was before. Okay, and then, you know, start over. Suppose instead of that, the government imposes the tax on the consumer because, you know, people might say, oh, we don't want to hamper businesses and we don't want to put people out of work, so we just want to make the consumer pay more. Well, you can imagine if the supply and demand curves are drawn differently, so that the supply curve is very inelastic and the demand curve is very elastic, then even if you put the tax on the consumer so that the consumer goes to the register, they ring up the price, and then they tack on $1 that the consumer has to pay out of his wallet, well, the original sticker price can go way down. So maybe it drops down to $2.10. And so the sticker price is $2.10. The consumer takes the cigarette up to the cash register. They ring in, they type in $2.10. Then they add on the dollar tax from the government. And they say, okay, you owe us $3.10. And so technically the consumer's paying the full dollar over and above the sticker price, but really the consumer's only paying 10 cents. Because if there were no tax, the equilibrium price would be $3. Now, because there is the tax on the consumer, the equilibrium price has fallen to $2.10. And so the consumer out of pocket is paying $3.10. So he's only paying 10 cents more than he would in the absence of the tax. And so the way that one would work graphically is the demand curve shifts to the left. And that's why the sticker price falls. Okay, so anyway, in case you got lost in those descriptions, I was changing the assumptions between the two examples in case you're getting mixed up. But the point is, you tell me what the supply and demand curves are on their elasticities. It doesn't matter which side of the market you impose a surcharge on. Either the demand or the supply curve shifts so that the original equilibrium price moves, so that once you take into account the surcharge, the distribution of the tax is still borne by the sellers and the consumers in proportion to which one is more inelastic. Okay, so now Rothbard doesn't like that kind of analysis, but I think he's just wrong. And it's not even that I like the analysis and Rothbard doesn't. It's that Rothbard uses one version of it in one spot in Man, Economy, and State, but then he doesn't use the same type of analysis in a different application. And so I think that comes up. Where is it going to come up? Well, it must be in chapter 12. So that would come up in, if you stick around for the third version of this, we'd get into that. At that point, I'll go over exactly and show you where he says one thing, and I think that it conflicts with something he says elsewhere. But anyway, that's a long roundabout answer to the question. I think, yeah, it is an issue of just definitions, and so I don't think it's right to say the mainstream is wrong, particularly since I think Rothbard uses that framework somewhere else. And the last thing is, in the part that you guys have read already, in whatever that is, chapter 3 or something, I forget where this came from, in the footnote, he says mainstream economists talk about elasticity of supply, but they're using the infinitely divisible steps or something, which is inapplicable for human action. I don't think he's making that up. I'm sure there are some economists that do that, but I can use that formula I told you, because I can say, take the price right now, and then what's the change in quantity divided by change in price, and I don't need to use calculus and make it an infinitely small quantity and price change. I mean, I can just do it over a discrete number of units and still use that formula. So, it's true that mainstream economists probably take the limit of that ratio as the deltas go to zero to define, you know, the elasticity, the instantaneous elasticity or something like that at one spot on the demand curve, but you don't have to do that if you think that that's wrong. You could still use the general concept of using discrete jumps. Okay. And then I think we've got two more questions on deck. So if you guys still have any other ones, feel free to go ahead and post them while I'm answering these. Lewis says, is the argumentation ethics approach by Hoppe related to the Rothbardian thought that we're analyzing? Okay, good question. So, just to bring people up to speed. Also, I should say this too, in case some of you who are listening to this recording, in case this is like your first class with me, don't panic. In these office hours sessions, these are free for all. People can ask me anything they want. And so that's why I'm answering these questions. It doesn't mean the fact that I'm dwelling on something in the office hours sessions doesn't mean you need to know this stuff for this class. Okay, so I probably should have said that in the beginning of the course, but I forgot to, because I assume everybody knows that. Okay, so again, just to make sure everyone realizes that this stuff is just, you know, people are taking the time to come here on Saturday and log in, so I'm going to answer their question, but this stuff is all extracurricular. Okay, so Hoppe's argumentation ethics, just to do a quick review for people who don't know what that means, Hoppe came from a certain philosophical tradition of a guy called Habermas. I think I'm pronouncing the name correctly. I'm by no means an expert there. And it's a very, and I mean this with sincerity, it's an ingenious approach that Hoppe uses, okay? What he's trying to do is he says, look, Mises tried to justify private property and things like that basically by appealing to the utility of it, the practical matters, pragmatic outcomes, saying, look, we all like living in a society where we have more houses and we have more doctors and we have more food being produced, and we just know as scientists from dispassionate analysis that if people are going around stealing and killing each other, that we can't live in a society like that. It only works if people respect property rights. And so if you want to live in a society that's very prosperous, then you have to be committed to property rights. So that was kind of Mises' argument. And Murray Rothbard wanted to make it much stronger. Murray Rothbard tried to say no and looked at natural rights. And he wanted to say that, no, it's not just a matter of if you happen to like prosperity, then you should support property rights. He wanted to say, no, the very nature of man himself leads us to conclude that, you know, it would be immoral to initiate force against someone because of these considerations. Okay, so Rothbard tries to give what we would now call libertarian rights a much stronger foundation than what Mises did. So Hoppe comes along and he tries to even one-up Rothbard. He wants to say, I can give an even stronger foundation than what Murray Rothbard did. And Hoppe argues that you're engaging in what's called a performative contradiction if you deny libertarian rights. Okay, so make sure you understand what that is. So Hoppe is getting that term from this philosophical tradition of a performative contradiction. So a contradiction, of course, we all know what that is. Like if I say, my name is Bob and my name is not Bob, I just contradicted myself. But a performative contradiction is something that the utterance doesn't directly contradict some other proposition you've made, but the very fact of you uttering it shows that the proposition is false. Okay, so in other words, the proposition could be true, it just can't be true while you're stating it. That's kind of the idea. So it's a true statement to say Abraham Lincoln is dead, that I didn't contradict any other proposition, any true proposition by saying that. But when Abraham Lincoln was alive, if he had said Abraham Lincoln is dead, well, then that would be a performative contradiction, right? You say, well, how can you be saying that? Or if I say right now, I'm not talking to you, that's a performative contradiction, okay? So notice, me saying I'm not talking to you, that's not a contradiction the same way that if I say my name is Bob and my name is not Bob at the same time. You know, that's more of a contradiction, or that's a different type of contradiction. Okay, so that's what Hoppe said. So if I say I do not believe in libertarian property rights, or rather if I say people don't own their bodies, then Hoppe argues I have just engaged in a performative contradiction, analogous to me saying Bob Murphy is not talking right now. Okay, and so I'm not going to reproduce the whole argument, but he goes through and tries to explain why that's the case. So if he's right, notice that that's an incredibly sure foundation for libertarian ethics and the libertarian approach to property rights, because he's saying anytime we try to engage in discussion of these things, the very nature of argumentation, the fact that we're going to take sides and you're going to argue one point and I'm going to argue another, Hoppe is saying that presupposes for us to even have this debate that we all concede we all own our bodies. And so he's saying it's a performative contradiction if you say to me, hey, I would like to debate the ethics of property rights with you because I'm going to deny your libertarian conception of ownership. Hoppe is going to say you just engage in a performative contradiction if you said that. Okay. So just so you guys know, I don't think that he's right. I don't think that Hoppe's argument works. So let me, for those of you who are logged in right here, I can dig it up for you pretty fast. So with Gene Callahan, we have an article in the Journal of Libertarian Studies. Okay, I'm just getting the URL here. Okay, so I just gave you the thing there if you're curious. All right, so with our time here, I'm not going to go through all the different reasons that Gene and I think that it's wrong, but if you're curious, you know, you can go there and you can see, you know, I think we fairly quote from Hoppe to establish what his argument is, and then I think we poke some holes in it. But to go, for those of you who are here in this recording and you can't see the chat box, the way you would just go to Google and say Gene Callahan, Robert Murphy, Hoppe critique, and it should be, there's one that we did on antistate.com. Don't look at that one. We have a better one that's in the Journal of Libertarian Studies. So, you know, it's a PDF at Mises.org or something. And you'll see that one. So Lewis was asking now, back to his question, so is this argumentation ethics approach by Hoppe, is it related to the Rothbardian thought? So clearly Hoppe just thought he was continuing in the tradition, and that he was carrying on the work of Rothbard, that just as Rothbard loved what Mises did and was trying to give it a more solid foundation, Hoppe thought he was doing the same thing. To endorse that view, we can look at Rothbard himself. That Rothbard himself, he was still alive when Hoppe did this, and he wrote a very glowing endorsement of it, saying something like, I'm trying to remember. I can't remember the exact wording, but saying something like, at one point of my life, I used to argue that we can never prove the existence of libertarian property rights in the same way that we can prove the existence of human action. Because the way Rothbard, in Man, Economy, and State even, says that, you know, the action axiom is, in a sense, it's undeniable, is to say, if somebody says, I don't believe in the action axiom, by saying that, they've engaged in action, right? They're using a means, their body and their speech, to try to disprove the existence of the action axiom. That's what their goal was, by saying that. So that's an action. It was an unsuccessful action, right? Their means did not suffice to achieve the end they sought, but that was an action, okay? And so that's a really powerful argument that Rothbard thinks shows how well-grounded the action axiom is. And he said, I didn't think we could do something comparable for libertarian ethics. I thought we had to, you know, he still thought he had proven to any reasonable person that the libertarian ethic is the correct one, but he didn't think it was as irrefutable as that argument establishing the truth of the action axiom. And then he said, but I was wrong. Hans Hoppe has now come along and given us this argumentation ethics that, you know, just blows it out of the water. And then Hoppe, so yeah, they're definitely related in the sense that Hoppe thought he was working in that tradition, and Rothbard himself endorsed it and said, yeah, this is great stuff. Now, just to be clear, I don't know, Lewis, exactly what you meant by your question. Hoppe is not talking about Austrian economics with that argument. All right, I mean, he uses economic science to make is some of the steps in his argument. Okay, so you kind of need to know a little bit about economics to follow the argument, but it's not that he's establishing Austrian economics versus Keynesian economics or something. So if that's what you mean, no, the argumentation ethics doesn't really have much to do with the content of Man, Economy, and State, but in terms of Rothbard's overall worldview, then yeah, it has a lot to do with it. But it's more about Rothbard's ethics as they relate to private property and, you know, do people own their bodies, that kind of thing, as opposed to how does marginal utility work, or why does the business cycle happen? Okay, Jan says, Walter Block says counterfeiting state money is not really counterfeiting. You replied that you disagree, that it is a crime. Could you please say why you think so? Sure. And yeah, let me get you guys the URL for that too. So that's true. In his book, Defending the Undefendable, hang on, I'm Googling this. I got to think about what I call that thing. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, unfortunately, I don't know if you're going to be able to, I mean, I'm going to send you the URL, but I don't think you can see it. I think it's just going to show you if you wanted to buy it, which I'm not suggesting that anybody does. So what Walter Block said, that he said, look, the state with its money, I mean, that's, he says that's not legitimate money. The legitimate money comes out of the marketplace, like gold or silver. The state came along, and you know, the same story could be told everywhere else, but I know the history of the United States is the best. So the U.S. government came along, and it originally defined the dollar as a certain weight of silver. And then later on, the Gold Standard Act of 1900, it established that a dollar traded $20.67 roughly traded for 1 ounce of gold. And that, you know, the language there was pretty clear. I just posted this on my blog literally yesterday because I was arguing with people about it. So I just went and reread that act. And the language is pretty explicit that, you know, people are going to come to the government, turn in gold, and then they're going to be issued treasury notes. And then that gold needs to be set aside in a special fund to be able to redeem those notes at the rate of roughly $20.67 for an ounce of gold. Okay, so that's why people were using the paper money issued by the government, is that it was basically just a claim ticket on gold, okay, and also silver in earlier periods. So, and then in 1933, FDR just said, actually, no, we're not doing that anymore. If you show up with your pieces of paper that we issued, we're not going to give you any gold. And in fact, everybody has to turn in their gold or else we'll throw you in jail for up to 10 years. Right? So that's what he did. And that's just is a historical tidbit in case you guys don't know that. That's why the U.S. government had to build the gold depository at Fort Knox, was because FDR took everybody's gold at gunpoint, basically. And then they had to put it somewhere, so they built this depository at Fort Knox. Okay, so that's where that's why they had to build that, is because they took everybody's gold. So they had to put it somewhere safe. Okay, so so Walter Block says, so these pieces of paper that the government prints up, they're in effect counterfeit. Right? That he said, this isn't real money. This is the government stole it from us. This is established through force. This is not voluntary. And so in a sense, when the government, you know, when the Federal Reserve prints up more, or technically it's the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, prints up $100 bills, he says, you know, economically and in terms of ethics, I, Walter Block, analyze that the same way I would analyze, you know, a person in a genuine free market economy who's counterfeiting legitimate money, because I think the government's illegitimate, and so they're just a bunch of counterfeiters. Okay, so now somebody in the private sector, if you go and tinker with your color printer, and so that you start printing off $100 bills in your basement, things that look like Federal Reserve notes with pictures of Ben Franklin and 100 and so forth, and the ink that looks the same, and so you start going around town spending these $100 bills that the police would say are counterfeit, I, Walter Block, am going to say that's not a crime. That in fact, you're heroic for doing that because you're helping to bring down this monstrous system. And it's not illegitimate for you to do that because all you're doing is you're counterfeiting a counterfeit. So what Block says, it's a crime to counterfeit something legitimate, and pass it off as the legitimate thing when it's not, but he says you can't counterfeit something that is itself counterfeit. So he said, you know, you're not purporting to be making real money, you're purporting that you're making counterfeit money. And so how can that be a crime? In a libertarian sense, obviously the U.S. government's going to say it's a crime, but Block is saying, is it really a crime? And his argument is, he says, look, you can't steal from a thief. So he's saying, let's say some guy goes and steals some other guy's gold watch. You know, he like sticks a gun in his belly, says, give me your watch, and takes it. Block says, if you go up to that thief and you stick a gun in his belly and you say, give me that watch, Block is going to say, you really didn't steal that from him because it wasn't his watch to begin with. Okay? Now, maybe if you do that, you're supposed to be able to give the watch back to the original owner if you know who it is, but Block's point is, it's not like there were two separate thefts that just occurred. That no, the first guy, or like the second guy, stole the watch from the first guy, but the third guy who came along and stole it from the thief, he didn't really steal it, because you can only steal something that is someone else's legitimately held property. Okay, so that's the moral framework that the Block is operating in. And so he's saying, given that framework then, it's not illegitimate for someone to counterfeit U.S. fiat money, because those dollars themselves are counterfeit. So how can you counterfeit a counterfeit? That's not a crime. Right, so that's where he's coming from. So yeah, you're right. I disagree with that. So I had a few arguments. I'll just mention two of them. So my first argument is, say what you will about U.S. fiat dollars, but they are money right now. There's a commonly accepted medium of exchange. That's the definition of money that Austrians use. Okay, and they're not counterfeit. That it's true, the economic impact of the current system we have is, for all intents and purposes, like counterfeiting. And I've even used that expression myself. I have an article at Mises.org called "The Fed is Giant Counterfeiter." Okay, but in terms of ethics, strictly speaking, what the government is doing, it's not counterfeit, because those pieces of paper don't say, they don't pretend to be anything else, right? That's what a counterfeit does. A counterfeit pretends to be something else. And, you know, so that's like a counterfeit. So something you printed off in your basement, you try to make it look like this was printed by the U.S. Treasury, when really, no, it was printed by Joe Blow in his basement. So that's why that's a counterfeit. But if you look at a U.S. Federal Reserve note, it doesn't say, this is a paper ticket claiming to give you an ounce of gold. No, it just says this is issued by the Federal Reserve, which it was. So that's a true statement, so that it's not counterfeit. So my point is, yes, what the government is doing right now is a crime from a libertarian point of view, and they're engaging in aggression and all that kind of stuff. And it's also true that if they weren't doing that, something else would be the money. But I'm saying, nonetheless, strictly speaking, Federal Reserve notes are not counterfeit, because they're not pretending to be something that they're not, and they really are money. It's not that they're like money. They are money. Money is the commonly accepted medium of exchange, and that's what Federal Reserve notes are for a lot of people in the world, especially in the United States. So that's one argument where I just try to just use definitions to show Block that, no, it's technically not counterfeiting. And then the other, and so that if a private person counterfeits the counterfeiting, then that's crime, even from a libertarian standpoint. And then the other argument I use, and I'll move on to the next question if there are any, the other argument I use is to say, look, let's suppose Walter Block is right. So he's saying it's not a crime for you to counterfeit a counterfeit, okay? Now, in terms of the economic analysis, who is being harmed when you counterfeit money? It's all the people who hold the money, right? It's not, you're not stealing from the government, per se, when you start printing off $100 bills in your basement. You're stealing from everybody who's holding paper dollars. And that's, I mean, it hurts the government a little bit to the extent that the government is sitting on paper dollars, and also to the extent that, you know, the more you do it, the less, the fewer people around the world who will want to hold dollars as a store of value. They might switch to some other currency. So yeah, you hurt the U.S. government in that respect, and of course the U.S. government cracks down heavily on counterfeiting because they don't want people messing with their money. So yeah, it does hurt the government, but it also hurts a lot of regular innocent people. And so the way I try to get that, drive that home, was to say, look, if Walter is right and it's fine to counterfeit $100 bills because those aren't legitimate pieces of property in the first place, well, then I said, by the same token, why can't I go up to somebody and stick a gun in his belly and say, give me all your cash, all your paper dollars? And then when he gives them to me, I can say, well, no, I didn't really rob you, because you see the stuff you just gave me, it's not really money. This is just all counterfeit, right? So how can it be a crime for me to take someone's counterfeit money off of him, right? If it were legitimate money, then of course I would be a mugger. I'd be engaging in theft if I took your money from you. But I'm not taking, according to Walter Block, I'm not taking actual money from you. I'm taking counterfeit money from you. So how can I be hurting you if I just took counterfeit money off of you? But yet, that's crazy. Not even Walter Block would praise the heroic mugger who goes up to a private citizen and takes his Federal Reserve notes at gunpoint. He would say, no, that you just stole from the guy. So I'm saying, by the same token, then, if I print off $100 bills, I am effectively stealing from everybody else who's holding paper dollars. Okay, I think we got one more question that I see, and that's good because we only got about 7 minutes left. Okay, Jan says, sometimes mainstream economists say that a supply curve can also be backward sloping. Similarly, they may say that utility from an extra marginal unit may actually be negative. For example, your 15th beer, after which you will throw up and you would have been better off with just 14. What's wrong with this approach? Okay, the supply curve being backward sloping, you're right, they do say that. Let's get fancy here and see if I can do the whiteboard. Okay, all right, so here's the graph, and then, so this is price and quantity. Okay, so a normal supply curve, of course, looks like that, so it's upward sloping, meaning as the price goes up, the quantity increases. But backward bending supply curves look like this. See that? So they go up for a while, and then they turn around and start heading the other way. So what does that mean? That means up to a certain point, as the price increases, so as the price goes up, 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 notice that the quantity is going out, is increasing as well in this portion of the curve. But then once you hit this critical point, now as price keeps going up, notice the quantity is shrinking. Okay, so that's a violation of the law of supply, right? Because remember, the law of supply said as price, other things equal, as price goes up, the quantity supplied either stays the same or increases. So if you have a backward bending supply curve, that's not true, because after that critical inflection point, as the price continues to go up, the quantity supply decreases. So there's a couple ways to handle this. Mainstream economists would probably just say, yeah, the so-called law of supply isn't really a law. Sometimes it's violated. It's just like a general rule, but it's not literally a law. Sometimes there's violations, and that's what this would be, a case of that. Austrian economists tend to not like to talk like that, and so You know, off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly how Rothbard deals with this. I mean, I'm almost positive he does deal with it at some point in the book. I mean, he hasn't dealt with it yet because we haven't come across it, but or at least I don't, unless I missed it, I don't remember him talking about this yet. He may get into, I'm almost positive A Man, Economy, and State, he talks about this, but I don't think we've hit it yet. The area, the one area where everyone thinks that this is true, or not that everyone thinks it's true, where it's intuitive to see that how this could be true is when it comes to labor. So you could say, suppose, so this P right here, imagine that's the price of, that's your wage rate, that's what you're, you know, how much you're getting paid for your labor. And so you could see in certain regions, so if you get like $5 an hour, you work a little bit. If you get $10 an hour, you work more, and so on. But after a while, like let's say here you're getting, you know, $1,000 an hour, and then you keep getting more. Now you're getting $2 million an hour. You're not going to keep working more and more hours. The point is that at some point, you've already got so much money. If your salary or your wage rate continues to go up, you're going to work less because, you know, the idea is what are you going to spend your money on? Like, you know, you already can buy yachts and cars and houses and stuff like that. And at some point, you're just going to want more free time to enjoy all your money. And so at some point, if your hourly wage, you know, on average, you know, depending on what your job is, you might not be getting paid per hour, but you get the idea, gets to be so ridiculously high that you actually might spend most of your time in leisure. And so it's odd that, you know, if you were looking at, like, think of that show Entourage, for those of you who have seen that show, with, you know, following the up-and-coming movie star around as he's, you know, his friends are tagging along. And so there, I mean, there's scenes or there's episodes like where early on where he gets into financial trouble and some guy wants him to, you know, to do a commercial, and he doesn't want to do it because he thinks it's beneath him. And then they offer him some obscene amount of money. I forget how much, but like $750,000 to go shoot for an afternoon to do this commercial that's going to only air in Europe or something. So he thinks it's not going to hurt his image too much because it's only going to be in Europe. And they're going to give him like $750,000. Okay, so he went and worked more because the pay was so high. Okay? So in that sense, you could say, oh, see, the supply curve was upward sloping. If they had only offered him $100,000, he would have turned it down and he would have just stayed at home hanging out with his friends and swimming in the pool and eating sushi. Okay, but because they offered him enough money, he went out and worked more, so the quantity supplied of his labor went up. But had he gotten, you know, a movie deal, he wouldn't have done that commercial, you know, for any amount of money, or at least any amount of money below $3 million. Okay, so... So it was like sort of a trade-off that it was, yeah, they offered him a lot of money, but it was also because he needed money, and he wouldn't have done that had he had enough. And so the same thing, too, I mean, his, you might think that, oh, because he can get hundreds of thousands of dollars for doing commercials, he must be doing that like, just, you know, for shooting for an afternoon, he must be doing that like crazy. But no, he only does it a little bit. Because he just does it once, and now he's got a ton of money. So, so that's the. As I say that, $750,000 seems like a lot of money. I don't think it was that much, but anyway, it was a lot of money that he got from that commercial. So, my point is, if that guy, now that same guy, if he wasn't a movie star, and he had to work at a factory, because he's not, you know, if you watch the show, he's not all that educated. I mean, it's just. He's really good looking, and apparently he's a good actor, and you know, so he's a movie star. But if he just had to work at a regular job, he would probably work a lot more hours per week because he would need to in order just to have enough to live a decently comfortable life. But because he's a movie star and he has, you know, he can get away with working really 3 months out of the year. And then the rest of the time he's lounging around. And, you know, he's doing stuff like meeting with his agent and reading scripts and everything, but he's not really, you know, his lifestyle, that's why the show is fun to watch. His lifestyle is pretty laid back. He's mostly going to parties and stuff like that. So my point is there, if you graph his supply curve of labor, it might look backwards sloping. that you would say, you know, if he's only getting $5 or $10 an hour, $20 an hour, he works 40 hours a week. But once he starts getting $100,000 an hour or whatever it works out to, $10,000 an hour, he actually works on average 5 hours a week. And so it would look like his supply curve is backward sloping. So I think, you know, so some Austrians might just say, yeah, that's fine. Or I think the way a lot of them would handle it is they would just say, well, look, other things aren't equal. That what's going on there is your wealth is going way up, you know, as that price increases. So it's not, so what the law of supply is really trying to isolate is what's called a substitution effect, that as the relative the use of your time, as it becomes more and more valuable in one area, you tend to put more of your, you know, more units into that to substitute it out of other things that are less lucrative. And he said, but there's also what's called the income effect, that other things equal, the more income you have, the more you're going to purchase of various goods, one of which may be leisure. And so they said, that's what's going on there is, yes, you on the margin want to sell more labor hours for pay the higher the wage rate is, but on the other hand, the higher your income, the more labor you want to consume. And so that would mean you're going to you're going to work less. And it's just that those two things, you know, counteract each other when it comes to the market for your labor services. So I think that's the way a lot of economists, well, every economist would handle it like that, but Austrians might say, so really it's not a violation of the law of supply because other things aren't equal. Okay, and then the last thing you asked, and we're over time here, so I'll be really fast, is you said about marginal utility. Right, so I think mainstream economists would just say that, yeah, marginal utility could be negative after a point, that you could consume so much of something that after a while further units make you worse off, and so the marginal utility of those units is negative. Rothbard wouldn't say that. He would say it's just no longer a good. Okay, so because for him, by definition, something is a good if you can use it to satisfy wants, and so if it gets to the point where it can no longer satisfy wants, then it's not. It's no longer a good at that point. That's, I think, the way he would handle it. All right. We'll stop there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Remember to do your quiz if you're taking the class for credit, and we'll see you on Wednesday.